Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is episode 6 of the Christmas New Scientist, and I just have read perhaps the best science fiction story or short story I've ever done, and now I'm reading the letters at the View. They have these beautiful King Wenceslas, these 6 King Wenceslas. So, King Wenceslas, King bestows gifts on peasants. Bad King Wenceslas, King steals gifts from peasants. Different King Wenceslas, no gifts. 2 King Wencelases, kings exchange gifts. No King Wenceslas, gifts divided between peasants. Philosopher King Wenceslas, king and peasants discuss giving. Quantum King Wenceslas, the gifts given and simultaneously not given. Apex Predator King Wenceslas, king devours gift and peasants. I like that, the Apex Predator one. Okay, just reading a few things here. We need to teach and promote the joy of failure. Your review of exhibition flop, 13 Stories of Failure, reminded me of finding Stephen Pyle's wonderful 1979 tome, The Book of Heroic Failures. Its guiding principle was that anyone can succeed, but it takes genius to fail in spectacular ways. The notion of that great success can come from great failure sparks much discussion amongst educators. Our educational system fails at all levels to teach students how to fail, about the resilience to learn and recover from failure. It is great that our pedagogy emphasizes student success, but it seemingly does it so at a cost: the creation of learners who are less tolerant to risk and therefore innovation. We need to work more on the joys of failure. Well, don't have to talk to me about failure. Okay, belief in an afterlife does not follow our usual logic. From Christia Nelson, Hobart, Tasmania, Australia. Graham Lawton explains in a clear and logical fashion why people believe in the afterlife. He overlooks the fact that many people don't think logically or clearly, at least from a scientific point of view. I would say, like, someone without logic is like, and you sort of like a wild bull in a museum that just create havoc and set off alarms. That's my view. Now, one reason why people believe in life after death is because they really, really want to exist. I believe so. It means that although their loved ones may have died, they haven't disappeared forever, and there is a chance of being reunited with them eventually. This is an incredibly powerful incentive to believe in an afterlife. Lawton suggests that people don't believe in non-existence because they have trouble imagining it. I think the problem is that many can imagine it very well indeed. This fear of disappearing further encourages them to embrace the idea of life after death. We see many instances in the modern world, for climate change denialism to homeopathic remedies, of people not valuing scientific logic and preferring the more human logic or narrative and intuition, particularly when it gives them a happy ending. Isn't that beautiful? I think that's with education. Why is education, you know, homeopathy? I think that, you know, we almost teach homeopathy at school. Okay, as neuroscientists who identifies the concept of me with a subset of complex activities in my all-too-mortal brain, I have no problem accepting the notion of not being after my death. As a former embryology teacher, I also had to consider the conundrum, which Lawson mentions in passing, of not being for aeons before my conception, being at some point, and later still becoming aware of being. Most of us spend large parts of every night in the state of not being, and only discover when the morning comes. When I had opened heart surgery a few years ago, the entity that I refer to as me failed to exist for a rather longer, but reappeared right on cue in the recovery ward. You have to wake up to know that you were asleep, and would have to have an afterlife if you find out there isn't. Lawton's remark is, "You'll find out sooner or later," is exactly what won't happen. Okay. We need to do the right thing for any reason at all. Roger Taylor, Mellows, Rural UK. We still have to do everything immediately to fix climate change, says Graham Lawton, but at least we aren't looking at doing nothing. The other day, I drifted into a casual discussion about climate change with a friend who turned out to be a liar. It demonstrated that neither of us had any idea what to say. The rather gormless polarisation we lurched into was a microcosm of a wider debate. Reason demands another way. I think everyone would agree that we are the only species that fails its own nest so appallingly. We cannot continue to relentlessly expel our waste into the air and sea across the land without expecting some kind of consequence to our children. Recycling can serve to prevent this. Even if you don't believe in climate change, better do the right thing for different reasons than do nothing, or worse, stand in the way. Isn't that right? This is really interesting. Interesting people are really blaming the fires on the greenies. It's just pretty amazing around here. Okay, survival of the Titanic demands steering. Fred White likens climate crisis to an iceberg towards which we, like the Titanics, are heading. To extend the metaphor, we are metres away from the iceberg and the ship's keel is broken. For every positive step we take to limit emissions, we slither backwards by electing Donald Trump and Jair Bolsonaro. Our only hope is for developed countries to get together to throw resources in finding ways to remove greenhouse gases. For the record, when an atom of hydrogen isotope tritium decay, it emits an electron and an antineutrino. That's correct. It's just like a neutron decaying. What the heck is that? When hydrogen when tritium decays, it emits. What does it emit? Oh yes, it emits an electron and antineutrino. It forms another hydrogen. That's okay. That's correct. Winter Wonderland. Dive into our 36 pages of Festus Special to find out Rudolph's real superpowers, meet our galaxy's worst behaved stars, dig up truffle scuffles, and make Game of Thrones look tame, enjoy tonic water, scintillating history, and more. So this is sort of lightweight stuff. Okay. Big tips for small talk. David Robson gives the science-based masterclass and conversation at its most social time of year. Conversation should be like juggling, wrote Evelyn Woe in Brighthead Revisited. Up go the balls and the plates. Up and over, in and out, good solid objects that glitter in the floodlights and fall with a bang if you miss them. How many of us feel that we regularly manage those acrobats with aplomb? Acrobatics with aplomb. Whether it's a Christmas party for a family gathering, the holiday season forces even the most unsociable of us to leave our shells and make small talk. Particularly when we are meeting new people, many of us leave a conversation with a distinct feeling that we could have made a better impression. That sounds familiar to you? I have two pieces of good news. The first is the reality is unlikely to be bad as your fears. The study is showing that we consistently underestimate how we'll be perceived by others, a phenomenon called liking gap. The second is the psychological research that can offer some definitive tips on the art of conversation. from the etiquette of eye contact to how much personal space is appropriate. The most tactful way to make an exit should be, should the conversation go south, the findings will help you present your best self at any social occasion. Close encounters. If you want to make a better first impression, one of the most important things is to understand that your words matter less than your general backdrops and feelings you and your inocular may be having, many of which are out of your control. Even the weather can influence someone's opinion of you, but you can avoid the subtle behaviours that worsen someone's mood. Consider interpersonal distance. We all have met people who get too close for comfort, but you don't want to feel like you're shouting across a football pitch either. The optimum space while conversing, according to a study of nearly 9,000 people in 42 countries, ranges from about 40 centimetres to 3 times that, depending on the person's culture and the nature of the relationship between you, among other factors. In research conducted by a team of University of Wrocław, Poland, the closest talkers were found in Argentina and Norway, where people are happy to chat with someone they knew for just 40 centimetres between them, about the amount of space you need to squeeze a beach ball. In UK, 99 centimetres is preferred for a complete stranger. That is around the width of a kitchen table. Between acquaintances, the ideal distance is 81 centimetres for close friends and falls to 56. That is just about enough room for you both to comfortably hold your plates and canapes without touching them. People in the US seem comfortable with slightly closer encounters and are happy with 95 and a stranger 69 for hurricanes and 48 for a close friend. If you're visiting Romania, however, be sure to keep your new associate much more than arm's length. For people, I generally prefer to leave around 140 centimetres between strangers. These aren't rigid rules, so don't take a tape measure out at each meeting, but do try to consider whether you regularly overstep the invisible boundaries. The greatest form of flattery. As all comedians know, one of the easiest ways to ridicule someone is to mimic them, hardly a good way to make friends at a party. Yet, subtle imitations of someone's mannerisms can lay the foundations for good rapport. The aim is to reduce the psychological distance between people, essentially by sending the signal that you are more similar than different. It's how we establish that mirroring someone's posture and facial expressions can help nurture shared bond and increase cooperation between people. Less well known is the fact that subtly imitating someone's voice by mimicking accent, pitch and speed of speech can also work in your favour. Even simply repeating or paraphrasing someone's words back to them can create a sense of bonhomie. The benefits go both ways. A person doing the mirroring will feel more positive and empathetic towards the person they are imitating. The person being imitated will be more friendly and cooperative in return. Look into my eyes. The eyes are said to be the windows to the soul, and for good reason. The eye contact helps us emotions more accurately. That's probably why we find it so disconcerting when someone avoids our gaze. It makes them seem as though they don't have something to hide or are untrustworthy. Unless you and your conversation partner are already in love, however, too much eye contact can be uncomfortably intense. One wants to feel as though they're being eyeballed. So what's the optimum amount? Nicola Branti of the University College of London and his colleagues fitted volunteers with eye trackers and asked them to watch close-up videos of actors gazing into the camera, so it looked as if they were staring directly at their eyes. Most participants were happy for a maximum of 3.3 seconds of eye contact before they started to feel uncomfortable, a finding that roughly fits with reports from real-life interactions. Shy people may find even this level of eye contact too intimidating, but further research has shown that most people don't notice whether you're looking at them directly in the eye or at some near point of the face. Don't worry about breaking your gaze and focusing on their cheek and forehead for a bit whenever you feel uncomfortable, because the eye contact illusion will still make it clear that you're listening intentively. Is that too much to ask? I recently met up with an acquaintance and a couple of drinks. By the end of our conversation, I was pretty sure I could write his biography. He told me his ins and outs of his job, his childhood, his love life. As for me, I asked just one question in 3 hours. This is a common experience, says Karen, who went to Harvard Business School, particularly when we are first getting to know someone. In first encounters, the default behaviour seems to want to talk about oneself in order to impress the other person, she says. It's rarely charming, as people think. In laboratory experiments, Huang and her colleagues have found that the number of questions you ask of someone during the conversation can reliably predict how much you like. They like you afterwards. During speed dating event, it is predicted how lucky you were to agree for your second date. The specific type of questions matter. Switch questions, which alter the topic of conversations, are less charming than follow-up that build up the person's current topic. Follow-up signals are kind of... That is interesting. Emotional responsiveness. This is distances. Oh dear, you've got different distances here. Okay, emotional responsiveness and care for the other person, says Huang. By increasing your understanding of the other person, follow-up questions should also ensure your own gambits are better suited to their interests. Get some rhythm. A verbal back and forth really is akin to juggling or dancing, with various studies confirming that talking in conversation is carefully timed. We achieve this coordination through subtle signals, marked changes in pitch, say, or slight stretches of the last word or syllable when we expect the other person to take the conversation back. If you are describing an event at an office Christmas party, for instance, you might say, "And then the whole room went silent," dropping your pitch and adding emphasis on the last word to indicate your story's over and you are ready for the listener's reaction. The following comes with seamless turn-taking and gives us the feeling that we have clicked with someone. The flow somehow is gauged to whether our relationship is good, says Naji Kuhnberg of the University of Göttingen, Netherlands. A study led by Gina Hirschberg at Columbia University in New York found that the shorter the gaps between turns, the greater the rapport reported between individuals. Slight pauses and breaks up the rhythm makes us feel uncomfortable. However, as though we haven't been understood or appreciated, perhaps this is why Skype conversations can be so excruciating. Kronberg and her colleagues asked people sitting in separate cubicles to talk to each other about their holidays through electronic headsets. During half the conversation, Julian was introduced 1 second later to the link, which disrupted their natural coordination. Afterwards, participants were less likely to report a sense of connection to the conversation pattern compared with those who experienced no delay. Kronberg emphasizes that this is all depends on circumstances. Discussion involving longer silences may be more comfortable with people you know. It's about respecting the natural beat of conversation as it unfolds. But if you often find that your conversations are a little stilted, it'd be worth paying more attention to the subtle cues, signal turn-taking. Recognizing the rhythms of speech can be also explain why it is often bad, but also sometimes good. Interrupt. Nothing is as rude as the tendency to speak over people. That is particularly common and annoying in the workplace. As my book, The Intelligence Trap, Constant Interruptions and Mansplaining Destroy Group Dynamic, Reducing the Overall Collective Intelligence and Problem-Solving Ability. Constant interruptions are the people who try to put the I in team. Yet interruptions can serve a useful purpose in some face-to-face conversations if they are used to maintain rather than disrupt the conversation flow. You might interject to finish someone's thought, for instance, particularly if they are already trailing off the sentence, since it helps the board the equal gap in the dialogue. One study of speed dating found that interruptions were associated with a greater sense of connectedness and understanding between speakers. So don't be afraid to step in occasionally if the main conversation is a momentum. Okay. Forget your phone. Would you like it if someone was constantly peering over your shoulder at a party to find someone more interesting or popular to talk to? No. Then don't fub either. This is the act of snubbing someone for your phone by interrupting your conversations to check for new updates. It's an increasingly common phenomenon, according to Karen Douglas at the University of Kent. People fub others all the time without thinking of it. It's a problem. Whether it's your hand or on a table between you, the mere presence of a phone may reduce the empathy between the people in the conversation, says Shalina Amiras of Virginia Tech and her colleagues. Other work has suggested that it may undermine the perceived quality of the discussion. If you want a meaningful conversation, just put your phone away. A soft exit. All of the pointers are based on the assumption that you like or respect the person whom you're talking to. But if you're stuck with a less than agreeable company, particularly with today's fort politics, it can sometimes be hard to find common ground. Fortunately, you can use the insights to put a gentle end to such discussions. Cordenberg's work on rhythm of conversation, for instance, suggests one way to tacitly signal your disapproval without open confrontation. Simply let a few short but slightly awkward pauses speak for themselves. Silence can communicate your disagreement, she says. You could also subtly change your body language or simply place your phone on the table to indicate your interest is waning. I like that one. Put your phone on the table. Okay. Appealing peels. To help celebrate the end of the year in style, we've teamed up with some computational artists to add a little zest to your holiday decorations. On the next few pages, you will find designs for three pieces of citrus peel art, along with instructions how to produce them. We've chosen Christmas tree because it's sensational, octopus because of our fantastic octopus feature on page 52. There you go. A stegosaurus because, let's face it, who doesn't love a dinosaur? Maybe your unique holiday diorama tweet us pictures with your creations to hashtag New South's citrus peel. So grab a statuma, a mandarin, a clementine, an orange, a grapefruit, tangerine, or if you're feeling particularly dexterous, a kumquat, and get peeling. So yeah, this is a ways to peel a peel some of these pretty amazing things, and that's a whole stegosaurus, isn't that an amazing peel? How they've done that? Okay, eight legs, three hearts, and no friends. I guess we'll finish reading this one. I've picked up somehow. Look, what happens is I'm working on this research paper, and this is part of the paper. I don't know what, every time it is, I wake up. Something sends me just completely to sleep. So I've written a paper, and so to get the wording better, improve it all the time, I listen to it over and over again, hundreds of times. Yeah, literally up to hundreds of times, listen to it. And this section of the paper, I just woke up afterwards. And so I must have been asleep for it. Okay. Eight legs, three hearts, and no friends. Cephalopods were supposed to be solitary animals, says Rowan Hopper. It turns out they like sun company. This is beautiful. It's a beautiful picture of some sort of octopus. It turns out the larger Pacific striped octopus has no scientific name. Its discoverer, Rodo Rocha, sent the specimen to the Smithsonian Institute in the 1960s, where researchers started a formal description and gave the name Octopus spilatus. Rocha referred to the description as in press, but never published it. Ron Canwell, the University of California, Berkeley, says he suggested to another cephalopod biologist, Eric Holden of Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History, that LPSO be named Rondaci. Sadly, Cromer didn't get around to doing it before he retired, so the peculiar animal remains nameless. That's a shame, because Holberg's was a great name. A stunning octopus he found in 2006 below was aptly christened the Wonderpuls Virginius. This is a pretty amazing one. Okay, in the late 1960s, Ardo Rocelli was diving off the coast of Nicaragua when he made a discovery that tantalized the cephalopod biologists ever since. Not only was the octopus found startlingly beautiful, another biologist later said it was the most beautiful he'd ever seen, but it was living in a den with others of its kind. That was unheard of. Octopuses are undoubtedly remarkable creatures. They solve puzzles, use tools, and even mimic another species. They have three hearts and multiple brains, with intelligence rivaling that of a famously smart animals such as crows, apes, and visual communication abilities are mysterious and beguiling. But octopuses have always been considered solitary beasts. The discovery of apparently social species was implausible, that few believes Rodanchi's story passed into legend. He published a short account of the species in 1991, but hardly anyone had seen the animal, and no one could confirm the report. It didn't help that the octopus had never been officially described. Gradually, the situation is changing. Work is emerging that confirms that Rodanchi originally suspected the animal registered is the only larger Pacific striped octopus, LPSO, seem to have social species. And a couple of other types of octopuses have now been discovered to show social behaviour beyond the breathless prospect of octopus communities with hive minds even smarter than their members. Oh, it's beautiful. And these breakthroughs indicate it is time for us to reassess the fascinating creatures. So this is what is called the larger Pacific striped octopus, LPSO. Is a small animal with a striped body about 7 centimetres across and spotted arms to make it look like it's wearing a polka dot dress. It lives in the depths of up to 300 metres in the Pacific Ocean in regions with sandy and muddy floors. Unlike most other octopuses, female LPSOs don't die after laying their eggs. Isn't that amazing? I didn't know they die after laying eggs. They also share dens with others of the species, sometimes up to groups of 40. LPSOs live for about 2 years, and the female lay their eggs over a period of a year, says Roy Cadwell at the University of California. I think the apparent social nature of the species has to do with the habitat in which they're found. Dens are hard to come by and may be clumped, leading to close interactions amongst individuals. Carol and his team found that denning sites persevered for longer than the lifespan of an individual. This seems to be because on sandy, muddy seafloor, that is typical of the LPSO habitats, suitable spots are few and far between. Biologists don't label them as such, but it's tempting to think the persistent aggregation as octopus villages. Christine Haller of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Institute, California, is one of the scientists who walked in Cadwell to confirm Roger's original observation. They hold a significant mystery, she says, picking out another behaviour unique to LPSO, the habit of mating face-to-face, more accurately, beat-to-beat, with their arms entangled. The LPSO mating system made us rethink what we consider possible for octopuses to do. Males and females of the species interact repeatedly in complex ways, further eroding generalisations that all octopuses live purely solitary lives. Most octopuses' sex takes place when the male passes a female a package of sperm called a spermopore and inserts it directly into the female. In other octopuses, species are able to mate with multiple males at once, but mating beak-to-beak, LPSO males can monopolize access to the female. The Your behaviour may seem to help the males that guarantee that they will father subsequent clutch of eggs. She can't crawl around and feed while dragging the mate in tow, says, but as occurs in other species. This limits female feeding activity, but also limits her mobility to keep her close to the dam and nearby male. It might limit her exposure to other males. But what's the most celebrated aspect of their body biology intelligence? Does this group living make Elpiso collectively smarter? We already know that octopuses process information in unusual ways, with their brains distributed through their bodies. Each arm effectively has its own mini-brain, as does the visual system. This allows them to multitask, so an arm can explore and manipulate food item while the head gets on with some other activity. This makes for eerily recognizable behaviors. In the lab, LPSO has been filmed creeping up on a shrimp and tapping it on the shoulder to startle it into its embrace. But octopuses' intelligence aren't necessarily the same as ours. And when they perform a complex task, it might not be that they are weighing up the problem and devising a strategy. They may just be following a simple rule that often results in a positive outcome. We don't know whether they are apparently complex behaviours are even underpinned by complex intelligence, or whether they're using cognitive shortcuts to govern their behaviours, says Alex Schnell of the University of Cambridge. In other words, it could all talk and no polka dot trousers. Octopuses of many kinds, however, learn. With Jennifer Mathers, University Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada, says, indicates the presence of organisational mind. Things that they learn, but as soon as they sleep, they forget, apparently. The matter points out, I'm being anthropathetic by making, by even asking the question. Every way of life has assets and liability. Sociality has its values, but brings competition. Even the most social of octopuses aren't great at interacting with each other. They don't tend to be good at recognising members of the opposite sex, for example. This is hardly surprising with such a generational overlap and short lifespan. There hasn't been much opportunity for evolution to work social interaction. Wolfitz suggests we don't need to fear hyper-intelligent octopuses' communities blocking the downfall of human civilization, but there is enough mysteries left in these creatures without hyping them up as sub-aquatic aliens. Recent discoveries of complex social behaviour in other species are reported by Hufford for the Alki octopus shows how much more there is to learn about the intelligence of this remarkable group of animals. I do love octopus. Or octopi. So, just going, there's the letters, the octopuses, which I found great. What was it? There's letters. And just so I can write this out. And conversation, big tips for small talks. And that's it. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.